Well, we will begin. So Maddie, since we last talked about Libya, Gaddafi has been killed and a new Libyan government has been formed. What is your reaction to the killing of Muammar Gaddafi?
Well, it was extrajudicial. That's for starters. It went against everything that the transitional council, the so-called rebels, promised the world, or promised their supporters. Everything that they said, that they would try him, that they would take him to court, but the first chance they got, they had him murdered. And I also want to emphasize, it's of the utmost importance to emphasize this, is that North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the leaders of the countries involved in this war campaign against the Libyan Arab Jamhuriya all were involved in Gaddafi's murder. This was premeditated and calculated. The convoy he was in was bombed by NATO. They knew Gaddafi was there. They knew where he was. It was bombed. For example, a Russian foreign minister and others have brought this question up because they are aware of it. They bombed the convoy because they knew they had found his location in CERT. They bombed the convoy and then they had the rebels go in. And by the way, these fighters have NATO supervisors with them. There's troops on the ground, special forces, or security contractors with them, who were there, who saw what was happening. So he was, this murder also involved Mr. Obama. Mr. Obama has a hand in it. Prime Minister Stephen Harper, by extension, would have a hand in it. David Cameron of the UK would. Nicolas Sarkozy would. And the rest of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization would have a hand in it. So this is not just this is not a group of ragtag rebels did it on their own. There was instructions by people who were aware of what would happen. And they allowed it to happen as well.
Now, you bring up that point that they allowed this kind of thing to happen. And it's a very interesting thing that they would do this, as it's supposed to be humanitarian, right? I mean, like, the mission is supposed to be humanitarian, yet they're doing extrajudicial killings. I mean, I guess. My observation is that if you needed any more proof of what they were fighting for was not really involved, I think you have it right there, right?
Well, the whole war was offensive. It wasn't humanitarian. The whole war was the antithesis of humanitarianism. You know, they bombed food storage facilities, hospitals. It was offensive. It was Orwellian. Without a doubt.
So when you say are willing, you basically mean doublespeak.
It was doublespeak. It was, we're saving the world, but life is death. Murder and lies. Lies are the truth, you know? Mm-hmm. The truth was turned upside down on its head to the whole world. You know, the victim was turned into the aggressor. You know, in this case, the victim might not be an ideal leader, to some, okay, but he was a victim. Like, I could be a thief, okay, for example, for argument's sake, I could be a thief, but that doesn't mean you have the right to kill me or to take my house away, you know, like pretend I stole something under 10,000 Canadian, but instead you take a million from me. Like, what happened was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization went in there for its own interests. It had nothing to do with humanitarianism. It put in lackeys and proxies into power who have helped undermine Libyan security and who've stolen from the nation. And today, Libya is no better for it at all. Every area in Libya has its own semi-government. We have warlords appearing. The country's divided. The Transitional Council only has power in some places, not even in all of Tripoli. So Libya doesn't even have a real functioning government. You know, in Misurata, there's the Misurata Military Council, which mm-hmm. runs the place. They give some lip service to the Transitional Council. In Darna, you have in a so-called Islamic Emirate. I question its Islamic values, because I really don't think it's Islamic with the things they practice. In the south, you have people for themselves. In Bani Walid now, there's the militia. There's militias. There's lawlessness in whole neighborhoods around Tripoli and other parts of Libya. You know, so it's turned from a united society into a me society, where it's every man for himself. And now there's tensions between Arabs and Berbers in the Western Mountains that are ethnic based, even though the Berbers are a very small minority in Libya. The black Libyans have been attacked and have seen the brutal violence. In fact, whole black Libyan cities, such as one near Misurata, gone, turned into shanty, ghost towns. You know, this country will not have the same living standards and quality of life that it had before 2011, which was it had the highest living standards in Africa.
Well, and that was my next thing I was going to get into, is really Gaddafi's legacy, that as much as he was, I'm not going to argue with anyone that he was not a dictator, and he was not brutish, and he was not a little boorish as well. There's also a lot of gray with this man, because, as you pointed out, he did create one of the most successful and expansive welfare states on the entire continent of Africa, where people were, at least some semblance of them, having a very high living standard. So could you talk a bit about Gaddafi's legacy and what that really is?
Well, I think for starters, we have to remember that this was a man who took over one of the poorest countries in the world. When he took over, it was in the same standards as Afghanistan, Somalia, very low standards. It was one of the poorest countries, not in Africa, in the whole world. I think it was number two. Okay? And this was while it had those vast oil reserves. So the oil excuse that people might bring up, some people might bring up hydrocarbons and energy. They might say he was abusing it. But when King Idris was there, they were living in poverty. Libyans weren't even allowed in hotels that Europeans ran in their country. The country was a client state. You know, there was an American base there. The British ran the economy. It was autocratic, you know. So this man turned the country from one of the poorest in the world to one of the countries with the highest living standards in Africa, and one of the highest amongst the Arab world. This was a man, a leader, who helped resistance and anti-imperialist movements throughout the world. Okay, he was one of the strongest opponents of apartheid. Which we can't say the same thing about Britain. We can't say the same thing about a lot of countries who dealt with South Africa during the apartheid era. But this man didn't. Okay, this was a man who helped Cuba and many Latin American resistance movements in Africa. In Africa, he's one of the most popular leaders and figures, and his strongest legacy will be in the African continent. There was a huge outpour of anger in the continent of Africa about what happened. He was pan-African, and he was pan-Arab. You know, he wasn't perfect, like I said. But let me tell you, people like George W. Bush, Tony Blair, and Obama have more blood on their hands than this man does. They have much more blood. I know this might, people have to think of it like this. He was I'd have to say he was a better leader than them. Than these people, even though he's a dictator, okay? And at the Arab League, you know, a lot of people always appreciated what he would say at the Arab League. Sure, he was amongst a club of dictators and autocrats, but when he was very forthcoming about a lot of things he said at the Arab League, you know? He even predicted a day where the United States would turn its back on its Arab dictator allies and hang them all one by one. You know, he was against the invasion of Iraq. He actually he had a vocal role against the King of Saudi Arabia over the invasion of Iraq, and the at the Arab League conference in 2003, and the conference was actually taken off air because the King of Saudi Arabia started cursing him about the issues. You know, during the Iran-Iraq war, a very bloody war that lasted 8 years, you know, that took over 1 million people's lives. He was actually on Iran's side. He said Saddam Hussein was suckered into going into a war with Iran, that Washington and London had basically manipulated Saddam into a war, and he said the war would not benefit either Iraq or Iran. You know, he always supported the Palestinians until 2001, 2003. He still supported them, but there was rapprochement with the United States, and as part of that rapprochement, he gave some information to the United States about his support to Palestinian resistance movements, and this kind of soured relationships between him and the Palestinians, and you know, the Iranians distanced themselves more from him. Already there was problems with him because of the missing Shiite Muslim cleric Musa Sadr from Lebanon. But you know, so this was a man who was very controversial. He also, women's rights is something else I want to bring up. You know, he's been criticized about women's rights, saying, some people have said it's only for show, you know, that women's rights was a pet project of his that was just to get the spotlight, the limelight on him, and international attention, or to make him look like an enlightened leader. But he actually, you know, in Libya, I'd have to say in Libya, the women were a very integrated part of the military and police forces. So he had strong programs for equality for women, and that is actually being reversed. One of the first acts the Transitional Council did with Tripoli, where they declared themselves the official government of Libya, was to revoke some laws about women's rights, like divorce laws and such. But this was a man who, like, there was more of a presence of women in the Libyan armed forces than there are in the Canadian armed forces. And it was very striking to anybody who's been on the ground in Libya to see how deeply involved women were in those type of programs and in leadership programs within the military.
Now, going back to a point you made earlier about the tensions and the rifts in Libya, you know, last we talked about the schism between black and non-black Libyans and the targeting of black migrant workers. So, explain more about the schism along racial lines. Okay. And how the new Libyan government is involved in all this.
Okay. Well, the new Libyan government has made some very ridiculous statements saying that Libya is going to orient itself more towards its Arab identity than its African identity. There's no reason that these two identities should not coexist at all, because Libya is just as much an African country as it is an Arab country. By geographic dictate, it's in Africa. It's in specifically the region of North Africa, but it's a part of Africa. So it's an African country, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just like how Lebanon is an Arab country and an Arab country at the same time. It's an Asian country and an Arab country. But anyways, it's in Africa. Its culture is rooted in specific Arab culture, African Arab culture. These statements that it's going to orient itself towards its Arab identity more than its African country are really ridiculous, because to be an Arab is a lot of things. Like, I repeat this many times. And to be a member of the Arab ethnic group to be an Arab in identity is to speak Arabic and to have a culture based around the Arabic language. That's it. Because if you look at what Arab people are a mixed pot. They're actually, it's a melting pot. The Arab identity is a melting pot. It's brought various ethnic groups or groups together under the banner of the Arabic language and a culture they developed under. So you don't need to be a Muslim to be an Arab, for example, because there's Christian Arabs, there's Jewish Arabs, and there's Arabs of other faiths, okay? The majority are Muslims, of course, but you don't need to be any specific skin color either. A large portion of Libyans were black skinned. They were black Arabs. Now, what makes them Arab was the language. So you had a large portion, I'd say maybe 25%, maximum 30-something, were black-skinned. And they were an integrated part of this country. There was ministers, cabinet ministers who were black. There was a lot of families are mixed. Part of the family is black, part's not. Some people's grandparents were black. Some people are black, but one of their parents is not black-skinned. Like, it's mixed. So you can't even sometimes know. Like, Gaddafi, for example, came from a mixed family, which included black-skinned people. Okay? His tribe is a tribe that includes black-skinned people. Okay? Mm-hmm. Southern Libya, specifically Fezzan, is filled with black-skinned Libyans, you know? There was towns in the north that were mostly black-skinned Libyans. So what's happened is, at the beginning of this war, the media here did something very despicable, in Canada as well, but the media specifically in all the NATO countries. This includes the British Broadcasting Corporation, very despicable organization in my eyes, and from my experience with some of its members. This includes CNN, this includes various French channels from the French Republic, from France. They all started saying that these black-skinned Libyans and the Libyan armed forces were foreign mercenaries. We don't hear anything about the mercenary story anymore, now that Gaddafi's dead and they supposedly have taken over all of Libya. We don't hear that mercenary stuff. We don't hear about how they said the jets were killing protesters. It's all been swept under the rug, because it was nonsense. It was fabricated. Anyways, they used these black-skinned Libyans, and they appropriated and stole their identities by calling them foreign mercenaries and using it as an excuse through media deception to intervene in the country and saying Gaddafi's using mercenaries against his own country. In reality, the mercenaries were on the other side. The other side's the one that brought foreigners and mercenaries in, you know. There was very little on the Libyan government side at all. You know, they might have had some foreign military trainers, but that's a different story altogether. So they used these people. They stole their, appropriated their identities, and they started massacring them. You know, the lies went on, and there was a hatred even groomed within Libya against them. And the whole black-skinned Libyan populations have disappeared. And I knew a lot of black-skinned Libyans who were afraid. But at the same time, because of these lies, that were formed, they were also targeting foreign workers from other parts of Africa, from Cameroon, from Niger, from Ghana, you know, from Nigeria. They were targeting these people, and this is part of the racist demonization that was used to justify this war.
Mm-hmm. And talking a little bit more about the Libyan. Now the present, the Libyan government, as it is, you know, last we talked, you talked about, and you pointed out again that some of these people are not real. They're you call them cronies. They're the real mercenaries. But one interesting thing that you've pointed out in recent articles is the connection between leading members of the U.S. Congress and the National Endowment for Democracy and the new Libyan government. So could you explain this kind of trifecta of how these things are kind of all connected?
Okay. Well, the Libyan government is formed by two waves of people, essentially. One is internal regime figures, okay? The government in Libya was not perfect. And some of the worst elements in the government have helped make this so-called new government. That included Mahmoud Jibril, who stepped down. Mahmoud Jibril was a cabinet minister in Gaddafi's government, okay? And he was one that was brought in with blessings from the United States and the European Union, okay? Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi, Gaddafi's son, who's right now being held as a prisoner in the Western Mountains, in Western Libya. When he went to Austria, he surrounded himself with figures from the so-called Western world, who became his advisors, and That's when rapprochement happened around that period, and that's when some of these figures were brought into the regime. A lot of these figures, like Mahmoud Jibril, switched sides, okay? Even the current president was selected by, he was selected by Saif al-Islam, okay? The other portion is, what you alluded to in your question is, it's people like that are tied to the National Endowment for Democracy, which is an NGO that is almost exclusively funded by the United States Congress, okay? So it's a very special NGO in the fact that it's almost exclusively funded by the United States Congress, and its links are so close that it might as well be an extension or an agency within the United States government, just like USAID.
Mm-hmm.
These figures who are groomed, these are people that are... We have directors in the National Endowment. We have directors in the National Endowment for Democracy who became cabinet ministers in the government. We have people in the National Endowment for Democracy who, before they even formed the so-called Transitional Council, were renegotiating the oil contracts in Libya. They did not form the government yet, but they had secret meetings to renegotiate the oil contracts on favorable terms. Okay, we have people like... Ali Ramadan Abu Zayek, who was a NED director, National Endowment for Democracy director on the board. We have people like Noman Benotman, by the way, who's a National Endowment for Democracy director, was one of the founders of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is a international terrorist organization. It's recognized as a terrorist organization. This includes the United Nations Security Council has even listed it as a terrorist organization. This was a man who worked with Osama bin Laden. Now he's presented the public as a reformed terrorist. You know, after 2001, he declared that he was against terrorism. And incidentally, it was the British that introduced him to Saif al-Islam. And he was key in brokering a truce between Gaddafi's government and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. But this was another NED director, and this was one of the figures that has helped overthrow the government, you know, from London. We have several members of NED that were deeply involved in this. Like, they had conferences about dividing Libya. Several years, in 2006, the National Endowment for Democracy was talking about dividing Libya, and it was actually alluding to this war. So it was deeply involved in this process. You have other people like Shamiz Ashour, who was also part of this, and he was invited to various conferences in organizations. Not just, he's a part of the NED, by the way. He's also a NED director, but he was involved in conferences like in 1994 for the Center for Strategic International Studies, which is deeply tied to U.S. foreign policy. He was there at a conference titled Post-Gaddafi Libya, The Prospect and the Promise, where they talked about this. You know, he later on went to conferences in Britain and in different parts of Europe over this, and he was one of the founding members of the National Front for the Salvation of Libya, which the CIA later adopted. It was established in Sudan when Sudan was under a government that was essentially a dictatorial government that was a client of Washington, you know, before it was reoriented under President Bashir, you know, mm-hmm. of Sudan, not Bashir of Syria. But these are the figures that were deeply involved in overthrowing the Gaddafi government, and the National Endowment of Democracy was deeply involved in another way. The National Endowment for Democracy is also tied to an organization that's based in France. That's the Federation for it's the FIDF. Okay, this is a French organization for human rights, and they are also have they're a confederated organization, which has several branches. One key branch or party was the Libyan League for Human Rights. The Libyan League for Human Rights, okay, which, as I said, is tied to this French organization, which is a partner of the National Endowment for Democracy, and the FIDH, sorry, FIDH, that's the International Federation for Human Rights, and the Libyan League for Human Rights, were very vital to getting to setting up the consensus in Geneva for the war, which, once again, I emphasize for the third time, that they're tied to the National Endowment for Democracy. These two organizations, especially the Libyan League for Human Rights, were the ones that said Gaddafi was massacring his people. Now, we have evidence that that's a lie, and there's no proof behind it, because the head of that, the Secretary General of that organization, says we had no proof. And when he was confronted and questioned in Geneva of where he got the information from, he said that it was Mahmoud Jibril who gave it to me. And who's Mahmoud Jibril? He was the man who defected and became the prime minister of the Transitional Council, who helped in the regime change agenda. So he was the one who fed this information, and he had no proof. Then when the Libyan League for Human Rights was asked how they got the other NGOs in Geneva to accept what they said, they said it was purely done on a social basis through friendships and social networks, basically, you know, through those connections. So all those people who signed, which includes a Canadian national, who signed the paper to take action and intervene in Libya, did it on the basis of no evidence. And then the Security Council didn't even check. And the Indian ambassador brought it up, said this is a very disturbing resolution because we're basing it on no evidence. We're taking action, but we don't know the facts on the ground. And they all ignored Libya's invitations to send delegates to study the country. Now they're trying to do the same thing with Syria, but they're covering it up. They released a statement in the same chamber that helped start the war against Libya, but the people who've passed that document haven't gone to on the ground in Syria. And the sources they're using, like the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which actually supports the King of Saudi Arabia, who's not a Democrat by any means, it's a spiral. The same template is being used in Syria, but I don't want to retract from the focus here.
Mm-hmm.
The other organizations that signed are people with the United Nations Watch, which looks out for Israel's interests and works for Israel. It actually works for Israeli interests, and it's the other organizations also included the Cuban Democratic Directorate, which is against the government in Cuba. You know, these are the type of organizations that signed that paper in Geneva on the request of the Libyan League for Human Rights and the French organization tied to it, the International Federation for Human Rights, which is tied to the National Endowment for Democracy, and that's how the war was started, through fabricated information. And as a side note, the Libyan League for Human Rights included at least three people who became cabinet ministers, a real conflict of interest. That includes Ali Tarhouna, who became the Libyan finance and oil minister, and the first thing he did is sign a paper to privatize all the finance energy sectors in Libya. So he basically let the country get plundered, and he was a professor from the United States who was brought in. So he was a member of this organization. The other two there was two other cabinet ministers. That's a real conflict of interest when you have the people who have a stake. You know, they have the actual interest in making these statements, are part of this organization. The Secretary General of the Libyan League for Human Rights essentially was awarded for this by being appointed the new Swiss ambassador, Libyan ambassador to Switzerland in Bern. So this is the web that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's
it's a lot. It's a lot. I hope. I was very clear on these connections.
Yeah. Yeah. No. You were, Matty. Now I wanted to kind of. I still want to kind of keep the focus on Libya, but how this. I mean, what you've just outlined. How this was gone about and kind of the how they went about attacking Libya and what it seems like they're doing in other countries as well. It certainly seems now that Africa is the new theater of conflict. If you look at the creation of AFRICOM, as well as now they've just Ethiopia has just invaded Somalia again. How do you see this whole thing in Libya tying into the wider strategic picture in Africa?
Well, first of all, Libya was a leader in Africa. There's no question about that. I like to call it the crown of Africa. You the crown, the head. You cut it off. You cut the head off. What happened to the body? Libya was organizing the African continent. Muammar Gaddafi was pushing for a United States of Africa. You know, this was a very important venture and initiative for the African continent. You know, he was developing, he was the force behind an African Central Bank. He was willing to send oil to the rest of Africa, not for cash, but for exchanging, for through bartering, in fact. You know, AFRICOM is very important because if you listen to the statements being made by American politicians and Pentagon officials about AFRICOM, you'll understand that the United States is using AFRICOM as the basis of creating an African NATO. And what is NATO? And we have to look at what the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization is a form of post-World War II U.S. occupation in Europe. Believe it or not, it's an invisible occupation, but that's essentially what it is. The United States has exerted a lot of influence in the European continent through NATO. You know, it's the leading power in NATO. Everybody else standardizes. They standardize to American requirements in NATO. It's a UN, it's a U.S. Flag officer that commands NATO, and NATO has a lot of political connotations to it too. But they are using AFRICOM to create. Not this is one of the factors to create an African NATO to push out to other powers in Africa to either push out any disrupt any independence movements. And when I mean independence movements, I don't mean for sovereignty. I mean economic independence, political independence, to make Africa follow its own political path in the international arena. They're disrupting that. They're pushing out competitors like the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, even the Indians. They're pushing out these people through it. They're preventing Africa from unifying. And AFRICOM gives them a blanket for sending troops into Africa. You know, Uganda, the United States, President Obama sent combat troops. You know, even the, it's no coincidence that Nicolas Sarkozy, Monsieur Sarkozy, the president of France, has also changed. Well, he hasn't changed. I think he's re-emphasized French foreign policy in Africa. He says France has the right to intervene anywhere in the African continent where there's French citizens. We can militarily intervene. He said that at a G8 summit this year, you know, alongside very close to President Obama. He made those statements. Okay, so we see them going back into Africa. They are going to prevent any independence movement. And when I mean independence, I don't mean national independence. I mean authentic sovereignty. They've targeted any country that hasn't signed an agreement with AFRICOM. Who are the countries that have not signed agreements with AFRICOM? Well, let's look at them. Sudan is one of them. It's been balkanized. I know one of the men who was a negotiator in the division of Sudan. He's an American congressman, Walter Fauntroy. I was with him in Libya. He was also negotiating. The State Department knew he was there. You know, the United States is not streamlined in what it does, so it had different bodies for negotiations. Sudan is one of them. Zimbabwe is another. And we know Mr. Mugabe and Zimbabwe have been isolated. Ivory Coast was another, and we know what happened to Ivory Coast about a year ago, the French intervention there. Libya was another, and Libya has been demolished by NATO and the United States, including Canada. Eritrea is another country, and the United States, if you look at strategic outlines and forecasts, says that Eritrea is going to eventually be occupied by Ethiopia. And who's Ethiopia, who just invaded Somalia? Ethiopia is in East Africa is the regional gendarme or regional police or enforcer or vassal of the United States. You know, first time it invaded Somalia, It was after the general in charge of the war operations in Iraq and Afghanistan had met with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia. I remember the first invasion. It was a month after they met. And then the U.S. Air Force gave them air cover. The U.S. is involved in the operations in Somalia. It always gives the air cover to the Kenyans or the Ethiopians. Okay, so these are the countries that are being targeted. They're not part of AFRICOM. AFRICOM is being used to legitimize U.S. intervention in Africa. And the war on terror has been forecast to expand into Africa. So that's why they're talking about these so-called franchises of Al-Qaeda in Africa, like the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. The U.S., the Pentagon's put a budget aside to go there. They're building bases. In fact, one of the biggest goals of the United States for the next decade is to establish more drone and air bases in Africa, you know, as well as the Arabian Peninsula. But they are going into Africa. They're going in for the kill. You hear them talking about fighting in Nigeria, and Niger as well. They're sending those ground troops, combat troops, into Uganda, you know. And it's funny that we speak about Uganda, because Uganda was, you know, under General Amin. It was not aligned with the United States. That's one of the reasons it was overthrown, you know. As soon as it cut its relationships with Israel and had negative relationships with the United States and Britain, it was demonized. I'm not defending General Amin, but I'm pointing out that where a country stands as a client or not, or its foreign policy influence how the U.S. reacts to it. Another case and example is Saudi Arabia and the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council. You don't see them, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, getting this type of treatment at all that Libya or Syria gets. So AFRICOM is just a door for neo-colonialist project in Africa.
Well, Maddie, thank you. We'll have to leave it there, but you certainly laid out a lot of very important information there. So I thank you for that. Again, thank you very much for coming on and explaining some of this this very important issue, or this very important web, as you put it. I think very sadly, I'll probably have to have you on more in the future to explain and to go more in depth into a lot of these issues that you've raised.
Okay, I also want to, since we're Canadians here, I want to point out that our country has a very dirty role to play in all this. The mandates or the justifications for these interventions were developed in Canada under the responsibility to protect. And I actually got into a fight with one of its advocates in 2006. Our former defense minister was actually given a role in the Red Cross as a humanitarian advisor for international relations. And he was pushing for responsibility to protect. And he was quoting Sudan as the case. He said we should intervene in Sudan. And I said that this is going to be it's going to be abused. And it really is. Responsibility to protect is also being pushed by these organizations, which includes the National Endowment for Democracy. Canadians should wake up and not let wars appropriating humanitarian language be executed. We, as Canadians, we have a role to stop this. A responsibility.
You're absolutely right. Again, Maddie, thank you very much, and I hope to talk to you again in the future.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. Have a good day.